Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens, a memoir of the Beals, the Maisels brothers, and Jacqueline Kennedy, by Jerry Torrey and Tony Maietta. Introduction by Albert Maisels. Narrated by Tony Maietta. For our mothers, Helen Torrey, Jane Maietta, and Mrs. Edith Bouvier Beal. It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present. Awfully difficult. Edie Beal. Introduction. Sometimes it takes people who are so different from normal for us to understand who we really are. Albert Maisels. If there's one thing I believe, and one thing that has guided me these many years, is that life, if you remain open to it, can be an extraordinary adventure. I have known this to be true in every situation that I have come across, and I know it to be true of my good friend, Jerry Torrey. When I first met Jerry all those years ago, in that dilapidated mansion on the shore of Long Island, he was taking care of those other two extraordinary characters whom I grew to love so very much, Mrs. Edith Beal and her daughter, Edie. Though in the film Grey Gardens, he seems to be just a handyman who was occasionally called upon by the Beals to fix a broken step or a leaky faucet, Jerry was so much more. He was their protector. His concern and love for them and their welfare touched my brother David and I deeply. And as our time together wore on, we realized that Jerry, too, was just as remarkable as the two ladies whose lives we were documenting. Here is a boy of 16, not more than a child himself, looking out for them, caring for them, loving them as if they were his own mother and sister. Indeed, we came to realize, in every aspect but biology, they were. More than that, as time went on and I got to know Jerry, I realized, too, that he lived by that same rule that my brother and I did. He said yes to life. No matter what challenging situation he found himself in, and believe me, there were plenty at Grey Gardens that would frighten most men twice Jerry's age, he went into the situation fully, working hard and doing the best he could until there was nothing left to be done. When I later got to know Jerry and learned of his astonishing life story, this seemed even more amazing to me. For a child who had every conceivable reason to say no to life, to throw in the towel of cynicism and resignation, Jerry always said yes to whatever life had to offer him, and usually with a smile on his face. I know this is the reason that all these many years later, his life has surpassed even my wildest imaginings. It has truly been an astonishing life that he's lived. I'm so happy that he's finally decided to put it all down in his life story, Grey Gardens and all, for the world to see. All those years ago, I remember Edie telling us in one of her more candid moments that Jerry is quite an extraordinary character. Finally, with this book, the world will see how right she was. Albert Maisels, New York City, December 2014. Prologue, 9th Avenue. It was years of living in New York City that taught me about change. Neighborhoods that I had walked in, lived in, and grew up in, knowing virtually every street corner and alleyway, would transform seemingly overnight into foreign territory. The Upper West Side, the Bowery, Soho, all daunting places to venture into when I was growing up, were now among New York's most thriving and desired addresses. Generation after generation in this city have simply accepted it, adapted, and moved on with their lives. In the end, what choice do we have? But as I got into my cab one November evening in 2005 and began cruising these familiar streets of Manhattan, I had no idea that another life change was in store. This change, however, would bring me back full circle to a time in my past to which I had long before bid goodbye. It was a moment in time that had been especially tender to me and has always loomed large in my memory. It was a part of my life that, in so many ways, made me the man I am today. Life has a way of taking on its own identity and asserting its plans onto you, changing everything you thought you knew and wanted. If you allow that to happen and simply give yourself over to it, it can not only change your destiny, but it can take you to places that you never dreamed of in your wildest imagination. Over the years, I had developed a lifestyle that worked well for me. I'd been a New York City cab driver for 25 years, and I see now on some level, I chose the job for the freedom it provided me. Working at night in the city appealed to me, as the customers were less demanding, and I usually found myself energized by the exciting pulse of Manhattan nightlife. It was my routine to drive through those areas of the city that intrigued me. There was the East Village, the West Village, Midtown, and Hell's Kitchen, specifically the area in the West 40s known as Restaurant Row, that was always a good area to cruise for a fare just before and after curtain time on Broadway. I was an experienced cab driver who knew the industry, knew New York City, and could get along with most customers very easily. That was one of my strengths, an ability to remain calm under very stressful situations and be respectful and courteous to my customers. Given my personal history, you may say I was schooled in the ability to remain calm under stressful situations. God knows, in my lifetime, I've had plenty of opportunities to perfect that skill. The night was well underway, and I had collected enough money by this point in my shift to feel at ease. As the night moved along, business continued to be brisk, and I found myself in a very pleasant mood. I cruised the east side of 9th Avenue and approached the Film Center building near West 43rd Street. As I surveyed the vicinity near the entrance to the building, I noticed my next fare, a young woman with a tripod hailing me to stop. The light had changed, the traffic was very light, and I easily maneuvered my way to the curb. I then popped open the trunk of the cab and stepped out to offer my assistance to this young woman, who seemed delighted to have a helpful driver at her service. She was attractive, with shoulder-length brown hair, and looked to be in her early 30s. Setting the tripod in the trunk, I returned to the driver's seat, turned on the taxi meter, and I looked through the open partition to greet my customer. It's always been my nature to begin a conversation with my customers. It allows a driver to find out a customer's destination, but also allows the opportunity to make a human connection in a sometimes inhumane city. It makes the night more interesting, too. For me, it's simple common sense to attempt to converse, and the customer can choose whether they wish to engage or not. This particular customer was very pleasant, and she smiled at me as she gave me the address in the West Village where I was to take her. As we began our trip, we made polite small talk. I had no idea that by the time we arrived at our destination, my life would be changed forever. "May I ask," I began, are you in the film business?" Watching her through my rearview mirror, her slight smile told me that she found my question amusing. "Yes, I am," she remarked. "I see," I continued. "I only ask because you don't see many people traveling the streets of New York with a tripod and film equipment." "Actually, I've been filming all day. I film commercials for liquor companies." Sensing her willingness to continue the conversation, I decided to forge ahead. "I love movies," I said, feeling suddenly embarrassed at the statement. "Have you ever met anyone who didn't love movies?" I tried to expand on the statement. "I mean, everyone loves movies, right?"
"I guess so," she offered. "I don't really work in movies, mostly television. Although I have a few friends who work in films, documentaries mostly."
Ah, something we had in common, I thought. So I took a leap of faith.
"Have you ever seen a film called Grey Gardens?"
"Yes, I have," she said, apparently intrigued by my sudden reference to a 30-year-old documentary movie. "I'm very familiar with the film."
Encouraged, I went on. "Well, I'm the young guy in the documentary. I'm the caretaker of the house. Of course, it's been many years since, but I find it a real treat that you know of the movie."
There was a long silence in the cab. "Wait a minute," she said slowly and in a low voice that made me look back at her in the mirror. "You're Jerry?"
"Yes," I answered.
She leaned forward and said excitedly, "You need to contact Al Mazels. He's a friend of mine, and I've been working with him for some time now. You need to contact him. He has been looking for you for years." Suddenly, my heart began to race.
Albert Mazels was looking for me?
David and Albert Mazels, the filmmakers who made Grey Gardens, were my friends from the mid-1970s when we first met, yet I had not seen them in the many years since the movie was released. It felt like an entire lifetime ago, and I only thought about that time occasionally
as one does with distant, hazy memories of youthful days long gone. But this remark, that Albert was looking for me, made it seem suddenly immediate. "How are they doing?" I asked, stunned by the serendipity of the situation. She suddenly seemed pensive and hesitant, pausing for a bit before she continued. "Oh, David passed away some time ago." Ugh, that news was a blow. Passed away. How was that possible? In my mind, we were all strong and healthy young men. David had been my first friend while filming Grey Gardens. I guess he sensed my uneasiness at the sudden appearance of himself and his brother and their ever-present camera in the Beals' home, and he wanted to make me feel comfortable. Right off the bat, he asked for my assistance in running electric wiring to the few working outlets in the house, negotiating the various traps in the mansion. This simple gesture made me feel a part of the endeavor and immediately put me at ease. I began to look on him as a brother, and despite the fact that we had lost contact over the years, this news that he was dead was a shock. My passenger reached in her bag and pulled out a business card and pen. "Here's the number to the Maisels Institute," she said, writing it down on the card and then handing it to me. "You need to call them tomorrow. Albert will be thrilled to hear from you." I took the card from her, and before I knew it, we were at her destination. I popped my trunk again, got out of the cab, and helped her to the curb with her tripod. Still somewhat overwhelmed by the sudden turn of events, I said good evening, got back in my cab, and drove away. To say that it was a very special meeting would be putting it mildly. Fate had once again entered my life, and I drove away feeling shaken to my core. The last time I had felt this way was some 35 years earlier, when fate had brought me to the front porch of a dilapidated mansion in East Hampton, New York. And, as it happened all those years before, I knew that something monumental was about to happen in my life. The following afternoon, I called the Maisels Institute. A woman answered the phone and then asked me to hold the line. There was the briefest of silences before a voice came on the line that melted my heart. It was Albert Maisels. Hearing the long-lost yet still familiar cadence of his Boston accent, I laughed with delight. We chatted briefly, each of us in disbelief that we were back in communication again, and made an appointment to get together the next day. I hung up and became overtaken with emotion. After all these years, I was going to see my old friend. That next afternoon, I drove my cab from Queens into Manhattan and turned north on 8th Avenue towards West 54th Street, the location of the Maisels Film Institute. Navigating through rush hour traffic, I approached the address searching for my friend and for a place to pull over. Just ahead of me, I saw a film crew assembled on the sidewalk, and for a brief moment, I felt frustration as I feared the intrusion of some film crew on location for some Hollywood movie would prevent me from my reunion. Then, standing in front of a crowd of people, I saw him, and I realized that the film crew was there for me. I laughed to myself at his uncanny filmmaker instinct. Of course he was going to film our reunion. He was Albert Maisels. So there he was, standing on the street, searching for me too, when his eyes met mine. I could feel the tears begin to well up inside me. I left my cab idling in the street as I approached him and opened my arms to a warm embrace. It was as if we were comrades in arms, reunited in the joy of the memories that only we two shared. Of all the people from our Grey Gardens days, only he and I remained. We were the sole survivors of extraordinary days spent in a magical mansion. The memories of those days had been isolated in my heart for over 3 decades. And now, with the embrace of this man who shared them with me, I could feel the years of stored up emotion release. After our greeting, Albert, camera in hand, got in the passenger seat next to me with a man carrying sound equipment climbing into the back. As I glanced at the sound man in the back seat, a sadness hit me for a moment as I thought of David Maisels. How I wished he was with us now, tucked in the back seat, holding his boom mic over our heads. It would have made our reunion complete. But still, I felt that being with Albert was wonderful enough. As we stopped at a traffic light, I looked over at him. His familiar face had grown older. His hair was completely white, and his face was framed in large black glasses. But behind those glasses were his eyes, the eyes that were the filter for his camera. What his eyes saw, his camera saw, and eventually, the whole world saw. As I looked at him, he gave me a sweet smile. It had been years since we had seen each other, but it seemed as if no time had passed at all. Suddenly, the voices of that distant summer began to echo in my mind. Edie, Mrs. Beale, David, Albert, calling me away from this cold November afternoon and into the balmy days of my youth. The traffic light soon turned green, and Albert and I began our journey, not only through the streets of Manhattan, but back in time to the golden shores of Long Island Sound and one unforgettable summer when I was 17 years old. Chapter 1. Life in Another Garden. In 1964, New York City hosted the World's Fair, and my mother took me there many times. It was in the Flushing Meadows area of Queens, a short subway ride from my home in Brooklyn. I remember the subway cars with rattan seats and low, slow-moving fans. And then once outside, the tall silver sphere that towered above you as you entered the fairground. But mostly, I recall the excitement of visiting strange new worlds that had seemed to appear magically from thin air, right there in my own backyard. Even the buildings that housed each unusual and exotic world were special. They were called pavilions, and they were arranged such that you would walk through one after the other and be entertained by what each sponsor had on exhibit. One of these buildings, the Sinclair Pavilion, had dinosaurs that moved with a touch of a button. However, the pavilion I remember most clearly, and the one that had a dramatic impact on me, was the Vatican Pavilion, because it housed art. I had somehow known, without understanding why, that art, specifically sculpture, would be a part of my life. I had always been drawn to the Gothic headstones that graced the gravesites at Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, and it was from these massive monuments that I would find my first interest in stone sculpture. Yet it was the Vatican Pavilion at the 1964 World's Fair that really brought it into my consciousness and lit a spark that years later became a fire of passion. Here, the beauty of the Pietà was explained to me by my mother, who, while grasping my hand tightly to hers, whispered, "This is the mother of Jesus looking at her son." The face of the Madonna as she looked down upon her dead son struck me. I couldn't understand how stone could reveal such tender human expression. And although it would be many years before I would pick up chisel and hammer and confront an unformed slab of stone, I guess you can say that attempting to chisel tenderness out of hard and impenetrable material has been, in many respects, the story of my life. In order to explain where it all began, I need to begin in Brooklyn. It was our city within a city. Within a city. Kensington was an Italian neighborhood that existed between a park and a cemetery. Now, most neighborhoods were a few city blocks. Mine was limited to East 3rd Street. To the east was Greenwood Cemetery, and in my childhood world of asphalt and concrete, this was our own private green space to play in during the dog days of summer. The fence surrounding the cemetery had rusted after years of neglect, and several of the widest gaps in the fence were known to the kids in the neighborhood. Slipping through these bowed portals, I entered the first of many gardens that would play such integral parts in my life. To our west was Prospect Park, where we went sled riding during the New York winters. The hill that only the most daring of us would attempt to conquer with our battered radio flyers was aptly named Three Devil Hill, and one cold winter day, when I attempted the feat, I struck a tree head-on and tore open the bridge in my nose. It was my mother's reaction to my injury, not the injury itself, that I remember to this day. Her loving concern and sweetness while tending to my wound. And it was my mother who, not long after this snowfall, I had to leave at a young age to escape my father. I yearned for the love of my mother, but she was as helpless as I was when confronted by the heavy hand of my father. Having nowhere in my home to turn, I ran as far and as fast from it as possible. It was only the strength in my body and my belief that there had to be a better life for me somewhere else that saved me. Brooklyn had its own magic for me, or perhaps more correctly, I found a magic within myself there. I had what would best be termed a colorful Italian family, all of whom were devoted to our family parish, the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Our lives were centered around the church, and the standards that we lived by were dictated by its rules and regulations. My father and mother were married in this church, as were all eight of my aunts from my mother's side of the family. My brothers, Albert, Anthony Jr., Robert, and I all went to parochial school there. I recall one afternoon in parochial school when our Mother Superior, Sister Aquinita, entered our classroom. Mother Superior was a commanding and intimidating presence. She stood in front of the room and slowly addressed the class. "Kneel beside your desks and pray," she said. "The president has been shot, and you must all pray for him." I don't remember registering shock or any real understanding of the situation. We simply did as we were told. I would never have imagined that in only a few years, the boy who knelt praying for a slain president would not only come to know the family he was praying for, but that two members of that family would become the most important people in his life. Unlike the Kennedys, my family never rose above working class. My father, Anthony, worked for the sanitation department in the city, and his backbreaking labor had allowed him to buy our modest home on the same block as the rest of his family. We were all within shouting distance of each other, you might say. My grandmother's house was just doors away and very old world, as were some of our other relatives' homes. In my earliest years, these homes were usually where I found refuge from my father. I felt safe there, and for a short time, I was safe. His fury seemed to seethe constantly just below the surface and could erupt like a volcano at the slightest provocation. His beatings on my oldest brother, Albert, were merciless. Albert was a natural rebel. He had an untamed energy and was forever getting into trouble. With each disobedience, my father's beatings grew more savage, but they only seemed to ignite Albert's rebellion further. By the time he was a teenager, Albert was an unrepentant criminal, committing crimes of increasing degrees of severity. Strangely, my father's solution to prevent his remaining sons from turning into delinquents was to beat us even more viciously. My mother, however, was the worst victim of my father's abuse. A slight woman of little more than 5 feet, he would often shove her against a wall in his rage. I have imagined what my mother must have felt all the years that I was unable to protect her, and for that matter, show her the very love I knew we both needed. We were living in a war zone, always on our guard for the next attack. My grandmother's house was one of the few places where I could leave my fear behind. My grandmother had 8 daughters and 1 son living under the same roof. The son, who was called Rubinoff, lost his sight in World War II and never left the confines of the house. I remember him sitting next to the refrigerator for what seemed like an eternity, tuning his radio. Also living in my grandmother's house was my Aunt Virginia's husband, Benny, a wise and loving man to whom I felt very close. He worked for the New York City Transit Authority, and he passed on to me a love of coin collecting, card games, and a sense of pride in my heritage. Only a few houses down the street was my Uncle Gaspar. He was a kind and patient man who reveled in the simplest pleasures of life. Each autumn, he would purchase crates of Concord grapes that he would use to make his own wine. I recall watching the press as it spiraled downward, pressed into the grapes, followed by the outpouring of juice. What a rich fragrance! He would then store the freshly pressed grapes in the cellar, only feet from where he slept every night. Like the rest of my family, he had a stubborn and singular nature, very colorful, very determined, and very Brooklyn. Today, I see that my background, with idiosyncratic characters such as my Uncle Gaspar, was somehow preparation for the even more distinct and extraordinary characters I would encounter with the Beals. Eccentricity was not something startling or frightening to me. I had grown up around it, and to me, it was a normal part of life. We played the games it seemed that all city kids played. The streets were our playground, and anything we could grasp in our hands became a toy. The kids in my neighborhood were tough, proud, and ready for a fight at the drop of a hat. My street, East 3rd, was almost entirely Italian. A few blocks away, the neighborhood was almost entirely of Irish descent. In order to maintain control over our territory, we formed a gang, as did the boys in the other neighborhoods. When conflicts arose between the Italian gang and the Irish gang, all hell would break loose. The conflicts between our two gangs were frequent and violent, although I also remember times when we would join forces to attack another group that was threatening our turf. It really was like West Side Story, but Brooklyn style. As we got older, and testosterone began flooding our bodies, the conflicts between each other became stronger and more intense, as did the conflicts within me. I couldn't quite understand why, but during my occasional tussles with other boys, there was an added edge of excitement that was something other than adrenaline. This culminated in an episode with a friend when an innocent episode of wrestling and horseplay between us developed suddenly into a more serious feeling. To my friend, it may have just been more roughhouse play. I knew it was different for me. I could feel something stirring inside me that both scared and excited me. The feeling of being physical with a man, the rough and tender, hard and soft push and pull, was an unforgettable sensation. I quickly pulled away from him and ran home, afraid that perhaps my erection had given me away. These feelings were doubly troubling for me, coming from the background that I did, because it was pounded into our heads by the nuns of the Catholic school that merely indulging in such thoughts was a sin that would leave us burning in hell. So at church the next day, I said 3 Hail Marys and 4 Our Fathers, in a desperate appeal for absolution. But even then, kneeling at the altar, I glanced up at the figure of Christ nailed to the cross, and the sight of his lean, muscular arms and tight stomach would lead me to brand new thoughts, and the feelings would start all over again. I was actually sinning in the process of doing penance for my sins. In my childlike mind, it seemed like an unending cycle that would doom me for eternity. To be fair, however, I must confess that I've been aware of sex for a long time. And while most children develop sexual awareness in their own natural time, other children, unfortunately, have that awareness brought to them. This was the case with me. My sexual education had begun a few years before, and I had been schooled by a much older neighbor. It first happened on Easter Sunday when I was 9 years old. We were all dressed in brand new clothes that we'd worn to church that morning. I had on a stiff white shirt and my first real tie that had been secured by my brothers into a double Windsor knot. We'd just eaten our big Easter meal, and we joined the rest of the neighborhood congregating outside, the adults to converse on the stoops and the children to play in the street. Included in the group was an older boy who lived nearby. I don't remember his age at the time, perhaps 14 or 15, but I do remember that he was old enough to smoke cigarettes in front of his parents without fear of reprimand. In fact, he boasted that he smoked his Marlboros right at the kitchen table. He was standing off to the side smoking while we children played together. When the others were not looking, he motioned to me to follow him as he walked away. I did so, and he led me toward a factory just down the street. Being Easter Sunday, it was closed, and the trucks that were used to make deliveries were parked, unattended, in front of the factory. They were cargo trucks used to deliver baked goods, and they had large panel doors on the side that slid open to access the cavernous rear area. I watched my neighbor as he approached one of the trucks. When he got to the side door, he grasped the handle and pulled it, and the door easily slid open. He looked back at me and then quickly ducked inside. I was confused for a moment, but also curious, and something else as well, a strange churning in the pit of my stomach that was a mixture of excitement and fear. Looking back, I think I knew what was going to happen in that truck, and something powerful inside me compelled me onward. This began my sexual education at the hands of my older neighbor that continued for many years afterward. Though I was only 9 years old, this was clearly not an issue to my perpetrator, who grew from adolescence to adulthood in the years of our involvement. As happens with most victims of sexual abuse, the experience...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?